Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 27. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who very generously pledged to support this podcast. A huge thank you to Andy, Joanna, Christina, Sharon, Jenny, Julie, Noel and Dawn. Thank you so much Leslie, Katie, Jenny G, Sarah, Shah, Beth, Carol, Caroline, Sally and Haynes. A big thank you to Stephanie, Stacey, Callan, Marcus, Lauren and Sarah. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website www.onthetudortrail.com or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before the end of March and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. This month's prize is a $50 gift card to ColouringTudorHistory.com. Home to colouring history, Tudor queens and consorts, a lavishly illustrated colouring book for grown-ups, and a range of fabulous Tudor-inspired gifts, designed and illustrated by the very talented Catherine Holman. Thank you, Catherine, for donating this wonderful gift. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about the literary afterlife of Anne Boleyn is Dr. Stephanie Russo. Dr. Russo is a senior lecturer in the Department of English at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. She specialises in early modern and 18th century women's writing. Her work has focused on exploring representations of politics, monarchy, power and revolution. She has published widely on a range of female novelists of the 18th century. Her current research is focused on exploring the ways in which Anne Boleyn has figured as a symbol for a whole range of ideas about sex, history, politics, gender, religion and power. She is writing the literary afterlife of Anne Boleyn for Palgrave Macmillan's Queenship and Power series, due to be completed in 2020. This project will span 500 years of writing about the Tudors, from the work of Sir Thomas Wyatt to contemporary literary, televisual and digital text. My conversation with Stephanie straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me today.
Oh, no worries at all. I'm excited.
Excellent. All right, well, maybe we should begin by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay, so my name's obviously Stephanie Russo. I'm a senior lecturer in the Department of English at Macquarie University. So I'm not a historian. I'm a literary scholar. My work has been in the past on women's writing of the early modern period, but I've sort of moved it backwards a little bit to focus on the Tudor period. So that's me.
Love
I
it.
also, I should also say before I forget, I also host a podcast of my own. It's
Oh,
called From the
do
Lighthouse. Yeah, it's called From the Lighthouse. It's run out of the English Department at Macquarie. It's a literary discussion podcast. So we have interviews and sometimes it's just me and my co-host talking about books we like to read. So yeah, maybe you should subscribe to that too.
Definitely. That sounds good. I'm going to have a listen to that. Thank you. Now, your current research is focused on the way in which Anne Boleyn has been represented in fiction over the centuries. When did your interest in Anne's story begin?
Well, I don't remember. I remember always being interested in her as like a teenager. I always kind of was fascinated by the Tudor period. I remember buying, you know, popular histories and novels about her. I don't remember what kind of prompted that, but I think I was always interested in this. And a lot of people actually tell me that too. Like, since I've been talking about this current research that I'm doing, you know, it's amazing how people will always come up to me, find me and say, oh my God, I was obsessed with Anne Boleyn as a teenager. I've always been obsessed with her. I followed her story. I buy everything, you know, that I see in the bookshop about her. So I think it's actually a really common experience to have this kind of connection with Anne. Sort of starts quite young, as starts as a teenager.
Yeah, that's really
like I said, I just was always interested. I just always remember being interested in her, and I just can't pinpoint the text or the moment. I have all these books about her that I've had for years, and it's just always been something that's there in the background of my life, that I'm interested in her, that I'm fascinated in her, that I read everything about her that I possibly can. It's just been there always.
Yeah, that's really interesting because obviously as, you know, Australians, which if you haven't realised by the accent, it's two Sydney-siders today, you know, we don't learn about the Tudors at school in history. Well, I didn't anyway. Did you have any sort of experience at learning about them at school?
No, never. No, absolutely never. No, I don't know. It's odd, isn't it? I mean, I must have picked up a novel or a biography that's prompted
right,
it, but it's just I can't pinpoint.
All right, that's all good. So what do you think was and still is the lure of Anne Boleyn? You've touched on the fact that obviously you connect with lots of people that are interested in her story. Why do you think readers are just completely and utterly insatiable when it comes to her story?
I mean, they certainly are. I think there's something kind of elemental about her story. There seems to be a kind of a Wheel of Fortune kind of rise and fall narrative that it's almost like a myth that we see in Anne's story, this spectacular rise of this woman who, you know, didn't come from the most aristocratic family. You know, the Howards were very aristocratic, but the Boleyns weren't necessarily. So she seems to come out of nowhere and blaze into glory and then so quickly fall.
Yeah.
So there's something kind of mythical almost about her story, even though it's very much tied to a specific moment in history. But I think there's also something else, which is like a soap opera element. It's, you know, the other woman, the marital dramas, the political kind of ruptures that were going on at the time. So there's this kind of mythical element, but there's also this, like, it's a really good soap opera-ish story. I mean, we love, you know, like the other woman, the marital drama, the executions, the six wives. I mean, it's almost ridiculous how fun and, you know, almost not trashy, but almost trashy in a way. It's like the Tudor equivalent of like The Real Housewives or something.
Yeah, that's right. No, well, honestly, I often say when I'm talking about them, you really just couldn't make this story up. It is just unbelievable, isn't it? Just the characters and the events. It's amazing. As you say, the soap opera elements there. So your work has...
I was just going to say, if you did make it up, people would say that couldn't possibly be true.
That's right.
You know, that would never happen.
Exactly. All right. So your work has involved reading and examining hundreds of books about Anne Boleyn. What are some of the common representations that you've found?
I think that I should preface the book by talking about how it sort of came about.
Yes.
So I've done a lot of work on 18th century women's writing, and I actually contributed a chapter to a book by another guest of yours, Estelle Perenke.
Oh, yes.
She was editing a book on representations of queens. And so I had this, I thought, okay, this is a nice way of marrying my interest in the 18th century women's writing to my, you know, obsessive love of Anne Boleyn. Mm-hmm. So that's how it kind of sort of came about. And what I found, and then of course I got, you know, really into the idea of doing an entire book rather than just a chapter.
Yeah.
I think what's really interesting is that every generation interprets Anne in line with their own interests.
Yes, yes.
So I mean, you know, in the 16th century, she's, depending on who you were, if you were a Protestant, evangelical, you know, she was your martyr, as she is in Fox's Book of Martyrs. Mm-hmm. If you're a Catholic, she's this, you know, demon spawn who has ruined Catholicism.
Yeah.
And in the 18th century, you find her, she's represented in a way that's very much in line with, like, almost a sort of proto Jane Austen heroine.
Right.
In the Victorian period, she's this kind of perfect paragon of perfection, almost like the angel in the house. Mm-hmm. In the 20th century, we get her becoming something different again as we, you know, get the rise of feminism. So she becomes much more, quote-unquote, feisty. Mm-hmm. And in the 21st century, we also have our own way of kind of thinking about her, which is bound up, I think, in third-wave feminism. So she sort of has the ability to become whatever that kind of society wants her to be or needs her to be.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's Hilary Mantel said something really interesting that I always kind of use when I'm talking about Anne Boleyn, which is, she says, you know, you can put the story through hundreds of iterations, Anne Boleyn's story, mm-hmm. and you know, you can, I mean, and I've read, God only knows I've read hundreds, and there always seems to be a piece of the puzzle missing.
Right.
And I think that's what that kind of missing piece is, why we're kind of we have a lot of space to fill her story with the kind of concerns of the day. But really the kind of standard narrative that you see now kind of emerges, I think, out of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So the standard narrative for Anne's story now has become, you know, she was this very clever child. She was a little bit different. She didn't look like everyone else. She had kind of more intellectual interests, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. She falls in love with Henry Percy. Cardinal Wolsey separates her from Henry Percy. And then she kind of becomes fixated on revenge. Henry becomes interested in her. She's not particularly interested in him, but she thinks, okay, I can use this as a way of getting revenge on Cardinal Wolsey, and then the kind of drama unfolds from there. So that's the kind of, like, the standard story that arose, I think, in the 20th century. So that kind of story, I think, has settled in a way that it didn't kind of settle beforehand.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting in itself. But I think that the representations are constantly kind of shifting in terms what our interests are. And I think that's normal. I think that's what historical fiction does. But it's interesting the extent to which Anne Boleyn has been all sorts of different things for all sorts of different times. She has this ability to speak across generations.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. And I think that is definitely part of the appeal that people see in her, I suppose, what they want to see in her, which is why she's got this amazing following even now, all these, you know, centuries after her death, which is interesting. And I agree with you about the, you know, the missing piece of the puzzle. I think the mystery that surrounds her and the fact that so much about her life is unknown, unfortunately, or you know, quite hotly debated, makes her really just interesting and fascinating and quite addictive, I have to say, from my point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, clearly mine too. But I think what's interesting is, like, we know, as you say, there's all sorts of facts we don't know. We don't even know what year she was born. But there's all sorts of facts that we know about her, you know, where she was on certain days and all of that sort of thing. But we don't know how she felt about any of it, because she hasn't left us anything, you know, any letters, apart from a few kind of form letters to Wolsey and so forth that weren't necessarily personal. She hasn't left a diary. She hasn't left you know, much that really tells you about what she felt about all of this. Mm. And, you know, the sources, the kind of the historical sources rather than the literary sources that try and get at that, are often incredibly biased and incredibly slanted. You know, the writings of and diplomats on various sides of the equation, and, you know, people that have a vested interest in presenting her in a certain way. So because there's so much unknown about her, we can kind of slot in whatever we think is interesting or important about her story. There's just so many gaps to fill, and that's the kind of, it makes her the kind of ideal subject for historical fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can see that in the amount of books that have been written with her as either a main character or in the story. So what do these many representations tell us about Anne and about how our thinking about women and power and sex has changed over the centuries?
Well, I think what's interesting is that we're actually still unsure about how women and power interact, because there's this anxiety that you see across the five centuries that hasn't really gone away. I don't think we entirely know what to do about ambitious women or women with ambition, because that's often the way she's been represented, whether she was personally ambitious or not.
Yeah.
She's been kind of thought about. So we don't know what to do with that. There's still a lot of anxiety that plays out in the books about her. You know, she's often represented as kind of overstepping, or, you know, rising too high, or wanting too much power, and that's what kind of led to her downfall, not being sort of sufficiently deferential to Henry, not being the kind of, you know, passive, submissive wife. And that's still something that we're grappling with. When she is allowed to feel ambition in books and movies and dramas and so forth, when she is allowed to kind of have that or demonstrate that kind of desire for power or desire for security or whatever it is, it usually leads to her downfall, or it means that she becomes sort of quote unquote evil.
Yeah.
You know, she might start in the novel, she might start as, you know, essentially benign and good, but it's that kind of contact with power, I suppose, that turns her into this kind of evil woman. So that's kind of interesting that we still can't kind of wrap our heads around women and power. And there's also a lot of anxiety, I think, about sexual power and how she got her power, because this is a woman who became powerful not because she was, you know, born to power. You know, she doesn't have the kind of power that her daughter has, for example. She's got, you know, the power of a queen consort, and before that, the power of the woman who, you know, has the king's affections.
Yeah.
And we still, I think, quite troubled by that in ways that sort of played itself out across the centuries of writing about her. I mean, in the 19th century, the way that they kind of grappled with that, the fact of her rise to power, was often to kind of ignore it and start the plays, because there's a lot of plays written about her in the 19th century, many of which were never performed, but some of which were, or they were closet dramas that were designed to be, you know, presented and put on with a small group of people.
Right.
So a lot of them start not at that rise where, you know, Henry's interested in her. They start when she's a queen.
Right, okay.
And that's a good way of kind of alighting how she got there, or not having to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, we will forget how she actually got there. We'll start with the queen, and then we don't have to deal with, you know, the sex stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just start with her in power, and then we'll make it a story about how evil people tried to bring her down.
Yeah.
And so they sort of flatten out that story, I think. We want to turn her into a feminist as well. I mean, in recent years, you know, we've looked at her, and I think, you know, quite rightly and appropriately thought of her in terms of what her kind of role in the Tudor court was, and how she kind of didn't fit with assumptions about femininity. And so we've wanted to see her as a kind of feminist icon.
Mm.
But I think there's also a kind of a confusion about how to deal with that. I think Philippa Gregory is a great example of that, because she presents herself as writing feminist historical fiction. But if you look at the other Boleyn girl, she's punished.
That's right, yeah.
Partially, and I mean, Mary Boleyn is the kind of model for femininity that is held up by that novel, but that's because she doesn't have ambition and she just wants to kind of, you know, live a quiet life.
Mm.
Whereas Anne, who is this, you know, blaze of glory, this, you know, meteor of the Tudor world, she's the one that's punished, and she's represented incredibly negatively in that novel that sort of purports itself to be a piece of, you know, feminist historical fiction. So I think that she presents a quite knotty kind of case study with all of these issues about women and power and sex and how we think about those things. And I think that we haven't actually, as anyone in the world knows, we still have problems with women in power, right?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we just can't get our head around these things in ways that play out in her story. You know, we love that she's powerful, that she seems to be this smart, intelligent, feisty woman who isn't, you know, submissive and isn't cowed by, you know, being a woman in this patriarchal world. But at the same time, we're still troubled by elements of her story that we can't quite figure out how to deal with.
Yeah.
So I think that's really interesting.
That is really interesting. And I think that it's interesting as well, because at the time, of course, I think there were lots of people that didn't know how to deal with her either. So it's kind of like we're still, you know, grappling with the same sorts of things all these centuries after.
It's quite depressing, isn't it? She still presents us with a problem. We still don't quite know how to figure her out.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Now, I love to collect fictional accounts of Anne Boleyn, so I've got lots of books on my bookcase, as I imagine you do too. What is one mm-hmm. of the earliest fictional accounts of Anne's life that you've found or read in your research?
Well, I mean, in terms of fiction, as in novels, mm-hmm. there's definitely some really early things. So there's a book. It's sort of a novel, sort of not. It's hard to, because at the beginning of the history of the novel, it's sort of not clear what is a novel and what isn't. Right. So there's this called The Novels of Queen Elizabeth, which okay. sounds like it's going to be about Queen Elizabeth. But the first one is actually about Queen Elizabeth hearing her mother's story. Right, and that's okay. by a woman, a French writer called Madame d'Aulnoy, who was a French fairy tale writer. Oh. And she wrote all of these kind of secret histories. So that was written in the 1680s. So that's in terms of fiction rather than something like a play, because she'd previously appeared in plays mm-hmm. as well as poetry. That's kind of the earliest kind of fiction. There's also a novel written in the 1790s called Historic Tales, which is a completely anonymous novel. And she's not precisely the main character, but it does follow her story as well as a kind of made-up story of a friend of hers who sort of comes and visits her in prison and so forth. So those are two of kind of the earliest fictions. And I would say that the first historical novel that deals kind of solely with Anne, mm-hmm. that where Anne is not just a secondary character, which she certainly is in novels before this, but this is the first novel where she's the kind of primary character, is a novel called Anne Boleyn by Catherine Thompson, okay. which appeared in 1844, I think, or 1842, I have to check that. So she's appearing in fiction quite early, but of course she had been in poetry. She was represented in poetry before that. She's represented in, well, arguably represented in Thomas Wyatt's poetry. Of course, Thomas Wyatt knew her in life. Yeah. She's represented in Shakespeare's Henry VIII. There's a 1680 play called Virtue Betrayed by John Banks. There's also some Spanish plays where she appears. So she started to be represented quite early, and of course, potentially during her own lifetime with the poetry of Thomas Wyatt. Mm. But there's a big blank. There's a big kind of space where she's not kind of in fiction or in a lot of fiction, because it's kind of politically a bit dodgy to right. you know, about her, because depending on who was on the throne and so forth. And so when you get the kind of span of time when it becomes a little bit less kind of fraught, mm. that's when a lot of representations of Anne Boleyn start to appear, you know, after Elizabeth's dead, when yeah. all of this is sort of firmly history, then she kind of explodes into the fictional page, and she's never really come off it. In fact, I've been doing lists of every kind of Anne Boleyn novel that I can find, and my 21st century list is as long as my 20th century list, and we're only 19 years into the 21st century. That, like, the trajectory of, like, you know, historical fictions written about her has only increased and continues to increase. I mean, I can't keep track of it anymore. I have to get an intern to help me.
Well, so, yeah, I know what you mean. I used to, on my website, actually have a list of all the Anne Boleyn books, and I actually just, as you say, I could not keep up. It was just yeah. unbelievable. They were coming out, you know, so often that it was hard yeah. to keep track. Yeah, amazing. And I hadn't heard of some of those, so that's really great. I've noted those down, so I'll have a little look. I like collecting. Do you collect books as well?
Oh, I have such a problem with book collecting. Okay. It's unbelievable. It's just, I mean, my house is a complete pigsty. My office is a complete pigsty. There are multiple books in my bag. I mean, it's just out of control.
I know. It's hard, isn't it? I'm exactly the same. And I think to myself, okay, I'm not buying any this week. And then, you know, something pops up and I'm like, okay, well, one's not going to hurt anyone.
I know. I thought I was going to, you know, be good this week, yes. but then later on today, I'm actually going for a meeting in a bookshop.
Oh.
And I'm like, yeah, that's going to not I'm going to come home with many.
Come home with something there. All right, great. Now, there's been obviously a lot of debate of late, which I'm sure you've probably seen and maybe taken part in, about how factual historical fiction should actually be. So what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I've been watching those debates as they sort of play out on Twitter and so forth. I'm more permissive of historical kind of fudging, but I think it depends than many, I think. because I'm coming at things from a, you know, an English literary scholar, literary studies, rather than a historian angle. So I have a kind of different orientation, I suppose. But I think that depends what the point of it is. So if these historical facts are changed in order to think through something or to kind of play with ideas or because some kind of, you know, larger point is being made, then I'm fine with it. You know, say for example, you know, the vexed issue of the recent Mary Queen of Scots film and the meeting between Elizabeth and Mary Queen of Scots, which history tells us did not take place. I'm less upset by that because that's kind of been a thing. It's been there since Schiller wrote his play Mary Stuart. It's been in a way of in ways of writing about Mary Stuart and Queen Elizabeth, that's often been a kind of forum to think about, well, what would happen if these two immensely powerful women could kind of just talk it out? So I'm actually fine with that. Where I'm less fine with is where history is presented, or fiction is presented as historical fact in this kind of unproblematic way, where people kind of insist, no, this is how it happened, or don't kind of acknowledge that it's a kind of not a fabrication, but it's not strictly true. So where there's, you know, people swearing up and down that this is true, that this happened, where it didn't, that obviously is a problem for me. And also where it seems to not do anything new, where it reinscribes old stereotypes, where it gives you really, really dangerous and problematic visions of the past as well. I think that sometimes inaccuracies can purport to tell, you know, a larger story about, you know, what the position of women was in the past or something like that. And that's where I think where it kind of gives you perceptions about the past that aren't necessarily true, that's where it kind of bothers me. You know, like, so say for example in the Tudors, which I actually really love the Tudors, I mean, it's objectively bad in many ways, but it's also, I mean, I think Natalie Dormer, yeah, is absolutely amazing. I loved
her. Yeah, I enjoyed her.
And I do enjoy the show as a whole, but Marguerite of Navarre.
Yeah.
The way that she's presented in that, she's this hugely intelligent woman. She's a writer. She's a thinker. She's got this intelligent kind of salon going on. And she's represented in the show as this kind of, I don't know, this promiscuous woman who just gives Henry the eye and then has a very loud sex with him.
Yeah.
While the servants outside are kind of listening to them have sex, and it just takes this woman who is this real icon of what women could be in the 16th century, and is so clever and is so kind of formative, I think, in I think even the way Anne kind of perceived herself as a woman, and it just turns her into a joke. And I don't understand why that was done. That didn't need to be done. There wasn't anything, I think, that they were trying to say except for, you know, Henry likes sex, but we've got that message already. So what's the message? Like, what's the point? That is what bothers me. Where it's done in a kind of more playful, more interesting way, in something like The Favourite, for example, which I absolutely loved, you know, that's not letter of the law, you know, historically accurate, but it was so interesting and it was doing such interesting things with the past that I'm much more permissive, I suppose, of historical inaccuracies in something like that rather than something like that specific example from the Tudors. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. No, it's and I sort of agree with you. Like, I can see the, you know, the pros and the cons. Like, obviously a lot of people come to the Tudors through fiction and something like the show The Tudors. And then you see a lot of people, you know, going on to actually do their own research and find out the facts, which I think is fantastic. And it's partly why it's so popular at the moment. But there is that issue of, I can't tell you how many times over the last 10 years I've heard people quote things like Philippa Gregory's novels as kind of backing up their argument about something, you know, and you just sort of think, oh dear, you know.
I know.
I suppose for someone that loves history like myself, it's a little worrying, but I do see how many people come to this, you know, fantastic period of history through fiction and fictional accounts. So it's good. It's a good thing. But something like witchcraft, if we take Anne Boleyn's apparent dabbling in witchcraft, which drives me absolutely crazy when I see people say that she was charged with witchcraft, which she was not, by the way, everyone listening, of course. You know, it's because of all that fantastic writing. And, you know, authors are very clever. And I think the better the writing, the more convincing, and people really do almost take it as fact, which is a little concerning.
Yeah, it is. Actually, there's a great article about Anne and witchcraft that appeared in the Australian Medieval and Early Modern Journal Paragon written by a guy called Roland Hugh.
Oh,
Hughie.
yes, I know that. Yeah, I know the person you're speaking of. I haven't read the article though.
Yeah, it's a fantastic article, and he talks about the rise of this kind of Anne as a witch myth is tied to all of these kind of weird anthropological studies in the 20th century, where she's kind of they've claimed entirely oddly as they've claimed that Anne is involved in some kind of pagan goddess worship thing, and that she was a practicing witch who was aligned with the kind of quote-unquote old ways, right? And so that kind of is taken up in the early 20th century, and then it becomes a kind of staple of historical fiction as well, you know, that she's either accused of a witch or actually is a witch. So it's got that story, that Anne witchcraft story, which we see in Harry Potter, we see
yes
in,
I know exactly
we see it in The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina as well. That was recently she was recently mentioned there as a witch. That's coming from the 20th century. That is not at all coming from the 16th century, or even, say, the 18th or 19th. It's coming specifically from the 20th century. So it's so recent, right? And we don't appreciate that because we read novels and we think, oh, she was accused of witchcraft, and then you take it up as just a fact. But it's not. It's just completely made up.
Exactly. That's just one example of one of the things that I think, oh, dude, it's just so interesting to see how it becomes. It kind of, we absorb it, and then it's like, you know, it's just kind of fact, even though it's not. Very interesting.
Yeah, and I think that historical novelists often read each other.
Yes.
And pick that up, and then it becomes part of their historical novels, and then it goes on and on and on.
Exactly. And as you said, that, you know, hugely popular Harry Potter films, obviously she's there on the wall, so it's like, you know, the connection continues. But anyway, we keep trying to...
That's right.
To share the facts. No, she was not charged with witchcraft. So I'm always ready to add books to my, you know, to be read list. What are some of your favourites about Anne, or just about the Tudor period?
Well, my favourite, which I don't know if it's because I'm a 18th century person, 18th century scholar, but my favourite is this chapter in a book by Henry Fielding. And the book is called A Journey from This World to the Next. And it's written by Henry Fielding. It's about a journey to the afterlife. It's written in 1744. But at the end of the book, his sister, Sarah Fielding, who is a novelist in her own right, she writes the chapter about a meeting in the afterlife with Anne Boleyn.
Right.
So, yeah, which is totally, it's what I wrote the initial chapter from which this book has come. That's what I wrote about this particular chapter. In this chapter, it's Anne's mostly talking about her life, not necessarily her downfall, but her life prior to meeting Henry. And she sounds like a Jane Austen heroine. She's talking about the courtship world, the courtship market. She's talking about how men operate within this patriarchal world. She's complaining about, you know, how men like the hunt, but as soon as the woman is caught, then they, you know, get bored, etc. And she talks about how she learned strategies in order to manage men and manage sexual attention from men. She sounds like a kind of cynical Jane Austen heroine. Mm-hmm. And it's so fantastic. And it's just this completely unexpected look at Anne. And honestly, it's one of my favorites because I don't think in such a short space anybody has managed to capture a more convincing kind of portrait of this, of Anne, who knows how men work and knows how to kind of not manipulate them, but knows how to function in this environment in which men have all power and women's only power is through men. So it's so clever and so funny and really very interesting. So that's a kind of off the wall choice.
Yeah, I like that. That sounds good.
Yes. But I have to say, I can't go past Jean Plaidy.
Yeah.
I mean, I know she's the kind of standard pick for historical fiction. So she's, you know, she's incredibly prolific. She's writing throughout the 20th century. But for me, Murder Most Royal and My Lady in the Tower, I mean, I think they're just great. I love Jean Plaidy. They're some of my favourites.
Yeah,
I also like, I also love this 1912 novel called The Favour of Kings by Mary Hastings Bradley.
Yes, I have that one actually. I haven't read it, to be honest, but I do have it on my shelf. It's there.
Yeah, no, you should read it. She's just, it's so clever. And there's a lot of conversations that happen in that novel between Anne and her attendants in which they're kind of talking about women and the way the world, the Tudor court works in this kind of like almost Edwardian drawing room way, because it's written in you know, 1912, so it's written in the Edwardian period. So that I find that really interesting. And I mean, it's kind of old fashioned, but you can see the roots of many of our current kind of historical fiction preoccupations in writing about Anne Boleyn in that. I also really love Nora Lofts, even though she dives into the witchcraft thing, which I don't approve of. I really like her books of concubine, mostly of she talks about servants in that book in a really interesting way, and the way that Anne's relationship with her servant is set up in that book is really interesting. And there's also a few, of all things, Anne Boleyn time travel narratives. So there's one Anne Boleyn time travel story by Nancy Kress called And Wild for to Hold, in which Anne, it's a short story written in 1991, and Anne is transferred from her time to ours. Yeah, as a kind of like the reason for that in this show, in this story, is because she is the cause of the English Reformation, and the English Reformation has led to, you know, untold deaths, blah, blah, blah. And so they want to not have those people die, so they transfer her into our world. And it's very interesting, and, I mean, it sounds completely silly, but it's really quite fun.
No, that's, I love, time travel novels are one of my favourite, but it's interesting that she's brought into our period, because, of course, normally it's a modern person, you know, that goes back and suddenly appears in the Tudor court.
Yeah, exactly. There's another one called A Rose with All Its Thorns by Lillian Stewart Carl. I think it's 1999. And again, she's not brought back, but her kind of spirit is brought back, and it embodies in this, it kind of comes into the body of a modern woman. And she kind of learns about modern understandings of femininity versus Tudor understandings of femininity by having Anne Boleyn kind of inhabit her body. It's really, it sounds, again, really weird, but it's great, very fun.
Yeah, that is, that sounds good. And you've just added lots of books now that I'm going to have to go and look for and be like, oh, God, buy more books.
I could go on literally all day. I mean, really.
So how do you fit in all the reading? When did you, like, or when do you do the reading? Is it, do you have a specific time when you just sit down and, you know, you start reading Anne Boleyn novels, or is it just whenever you can fit it in?
Whenever I can fit it in, you know, any spare moment. I had some research leave last year, so I was able to do a lot of reading then. But sadly, I am not on research leave at the moment, so it is a bit more difficult when I'm, you know, teaching and and doing my job. Yeah, I'm just trying to read as much as I can, as quickly as I can. I'm a pretty fast reader, which is good. Yeah, well, I've had to be. I mean, I couldn't possibly do this this project without getting through them fast. But, you know, at the moment, I'm sort of struggling under the weight of them. I'm writing my 20th century chapter at the moment, and I need to read a few more books for the 20th century. And I'm just, you know, everyone go away. I just want to read.
I know, if only that. Have you read, this isn't exactly fiction, but I'm trying to remember and I can't see it. I'm looking on my shelf and I can't see it, but I think it's called A Tudor Story. And is it Pakenham Walsh or that? Something like that. Yeah, have you read that one?
Yes, I have. So that's about a clergyman who believes that he's had these encounters with the ghost of Anne Boleyn through the intervention of mediums. I actually just wrote a journal article on Anne Boleyn ghosts. Yeah, because there's been so many stories about, you know, people seeing her ghost, blah, 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 as well as her ghost often appears in fiction.
That's fascinating. I love the stories of Anne appearing at various places. They're just fascinating.
Yeah, and that's such a weird book. And it's such a weird book.
It is a weird book, but something about it that I don't know. Obviously it depends what you believe on this matter, but I felt that it was kind of quite genuine, like, as in, you know, from the author's point of view.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And like the thing that I find sad is that his child has died.
Yeah.
And he's really trying to kind of convince himself of the afterlife, right? And it's obviously, you know, he's this man who thinks that he has a spiritual connection with Anne Boleyn, and she turns up and she, you know, tells him all this stuff. And what makes me laugh about that book is the scene in which Henry appears and Henry starts talking about the Charles Lawton film. And he starts saying, oh, you know, that Charles Lawton, Private Lives of Henry VIII, that was a terrible film. I hated it. And I'm like, is Ghost Henry going to the movies? Anyway. So there's a lot that's quite funny about that book, but it's also quite sad because he's, you know, this grieving father, and he keeps mentioning his dead children or his dead child, and you think that's why you're into this, you know,
exactly.
Spiritualism is often driven by, you know, grieving and, you know, that kind of need to convince yourself that there is a life beyond death. But so, yeah, there it is. I think it absolutely is genuine, and it's quite a weird read, but it's a weird read.
Yeah. But I recommend it if people haven't read it. I think it's something different, isn't it? And it's interesting. Yeah. I think there's a line in there that there was a favorite line in there that I just loved, and where he says something, this is, you know, just not exactly what he said, but something along the lines of, is there anything greater than, you know, for a history lover to stand in the spot where someone, you know, like Anne Boleyn stood? And I just connected so much with that, because that's what's driven all my research and kind of work in the last decade, is I love that idea that when we stand somewhere where they've stood, suddenly this great gulf, you know, normally, especially us, because being Sydneysiders, we're separated by this huge gulf of time and, you know, thousands and thousands of kilometers or miles or whatever. So when you're standing there, suddenly this gulf shifts, and it's just the time that separates us. And we know so little about that, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that's why we like the ghost story, because it's an encounter, like, oh, I could potentially encounter Anne Boleyn at the Tower or at Heath Castle or at Hampton Court, whatever. I might be able to see. It's like I can touch the past or something, you know?
Exactly. I know. And that's why some of my favorite stories are the time slip stories. I'm constantly searching for time slip. I just love that idea that I can, you know, be strolling through the gardens and suddenly end up in Tudor England. So it's so, you know, wonderful.
There's a new time, or new, I think it came out in 2013. Mm-hmm. I don't know, or maybe earlier than that, I can't remember now. There's too many books for me to keep them all in track. Yeah. Called The 48. Mm-hmm. And it's a YA novel that's a time slip novel. And so you might want to have a look at that. I can't remember who it's by, but it's about this like time travel institute. And there's, I think you would know this book, Sarah Morris's Le Temps. Yes.
Yeah, which is fantastic. Also, yeah, definitely. And so when you did your recent article about the ghost site, is that about ghost sightings of Anne Boleyn? Is that what you wrote?
It's about both ghost like folklore ghost sightings, as well as where her ghost appears in fiction. There's a play called Anne Boleyn by Howard Brenton, which was put on in 2010, in which she appears as a ghost to James the First of England. So she's a ghost in that play, as well as other novels in which she appears as a ghost. So it's both about the sightings and the folklore, as well as the ghosts, where she's a ghost in fiction.
Okay. Well, it's been, I haven't. Sorry.
She's very often a ghost in fiction.
yeah, I know. And she's been seen in so many places. But I was just thinking, it's been a while since we've had an Anne Boleyn ghost sighting at somewhere in England. I haven't heard of a report of a ghost sighting for quite some time.
That is true. But, you know, Meghan Markle's sister, when there was a story about Meghan Markle wanting deodorant or air fresheners or whatever it was in Windsor Castle, she tweeted something like, oh, you know, Meghan Markle's sister, who's in this, you know, complicated hate relationship with her, she tweeted something like, well, what if sis sees the ghost of Anne Boleyn walking down Windsor Castle, you know? So she's
funny. I didn't see that. Yeah, that's interesting. And there is, I think there's a story. Well, actually, I think the most famous story there is about Henry appearing at a window or something, or he's dragging his leg or some, you know, funny story like that. Yep. So interesting. All right. Well, and your book, so I think, is the working title The Literary Afterlife of Anne Boleyn?
Yes, it is. That is the working title. It's due 2020. It's due May 2020 to my publishers, but so I assume it'll be, say, 2021 or late 2020, provided all goes well and I finish all my reading. So it's still a while away, but I'm having so much fun writing it.
Oh, that's fantastic. I can't wait to read that. That's going to be great. So it's time now, Stephanie, for us to play our little game of 10 to go. Are you ready for it?
I am ready.
Fantastic. So first question, when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a teacher at some point, which I'm not a teacher, but I do teach university students.
Teach,
so I'm fulfilled. I think that's what I wanted to be from memory. Yeah.
Excellent. All right. And do you have a bucket list
kind of
your mind? Yeah. Not a physical one. And what are two items that are on that list that you'd like to achieve or do?
Well, I've recently become obsessed with Anne Cleve's crime novels, Shetland crime novels. She's got a Shetland series set on the Shetland Islands in northern Scotland. So I'd love to go to the Shetland Islands. So that is one of my bucket list items. And my other bucket list item would be to move to Tasmania.
Oh, I love that one too. I always have a fantasy of moving to Tasmania as well.
I'm just absolutely in love with Hobart. I just think it's the greatest of all cities. And I just would love to, you know, buy a house on the water and quietly read
Yeah.
for the rest of my life.
That sounds fantastic. I know, and it's I suppose, well, apart from a few other areas, it's quite it does remind me of England, a lot of the
Well,
parts, so.
it's and that's what the original when the people English people started to colonize Van Diemen's Land at the time. That's what they said about Tasmania. It's just like England
It's
because it's
just like
cold.
England. Yeah, it's cold, exactly, and quite green, which is lovely. All right, so what's an early childhood memory that you have?
Do you know my first childhood memory? I'm hoping my brother doesn't listen to this. My first childhood memory is actually my grandparents telling me I had a brother.
Oh.
And I just have this really, I have this specific memory of where I was in my grandparents' house. And I remember being told I had a brother, and I was so crushingly disappointed because I wanted a sister.
Oh, I'm sure you grew to love him after
Yes, absolutely. But that was my strongest because I was a very girly girl, and I liked,
Yeah.
stories about girls and, girls around me all the time. And I wanted a sister, and I had a brother, and
Yeah.
was very
All right. So if you're feeling a little kind of uninspired, what kind of things do you do to find inspiration or to get back in that inspired mode? Yeah.
I read a lot. Yeah, I mean, when I'm kind of needing a kind of break from all of this, I read a lot of crime novels. That's
Right.
my kind of when I'm not reading and learn historical fiction. I also like to go on walks,
Yes, yeah.
and listen to podcasts or audiobooks. I just find, if I'm out in the fresh air, it kind of clears my head,
Exactly.
takes me out of my head in a way. Because I think working in academia and writing a book and reading all of this stuff, you can tend to get very kind of caught up, and
Definitely.
sometimes you just need to like walk along and just listen to something that's unconnected to anything that you ever do in your life, or just experience nature. So I suppose going for a walk is also very good for me.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree. I try and do that a lot because, as you say, you can kind of just disconnect from everything for a little bit, which is kind of
That's
nice.
right.
What's something you love? Well, obviously, we both live in Sydney. What's something you love about living in Sydney?
The harbour is so beautiful.
It is,
There's so many things that I dislike about living in Sydney: the traffic, the
yeah.
noise. It's very hectic. But any time that I, am away from Sydney and you fly in over the harbour,
Yeah.
oh God, it's so beautiful. It really is the most gorgeous city. So I just love the beauty of Sydney is just constantly hits me in the face. I went to the city yesterday, and I was just walking along beside the Opera House, and I just looked up and thought, God, I'm lucky.
Oh
And I
yeah.
have to remember that, like, struggling with buses, and there's stuck in somewhere. I have to remember, okay, you live in one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Calm down.
Yeah, definitely. And I know I absolutely love traveling, but there's nothing like that moment of arriving home. It's just such an amazing feeling. And the harbour is absolutely beautiful. That's so true.
That's back into Sydney, it always gets me for some reason when you look out and you see the
Yeah.
harbour just below you, and you're like, oh God.
It is, yeah, it's absolutely stunning, definitely. All right, what was the last thing you bought? Can you remember? I have a feeling it might be a book, but what's the last thing you
Oh,
bought?
God, the last thing I bought, it was probably a book.
Yeah,
What
that would
was
be
it?
mine, that's for sure.
Actually, no, it was a book, not for myself. My brother and his wife are having a baby, so I bought
Oh.
them a book for the baby.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yes. See, I'm
Excellent.
nice to my brother in the end.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. You like him now, so that's good. What was a favorite childhood movie or book of yours that you really loved?
This might account for my love of time travel stories, but Back to the Future was my absolute favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Childhood movie. I probably could recite those films, to be honest, and I find it almost impossible. They're always played on reruns on,
Yeah.
9 Sunday nights at 10:30 or whatever, and so I can't not watch them. I just love them. I know that they're,
Yeah, they're
very,
fantastic. I love those movies as well.
yeah, they're just so much fun. I just love the Back to the Future movies. That's my like constant touchstone.
I know, and I love the representation of like what we should be doing now, which all the clothes we should be wearing in our modern times. It's so fantastic.
Where am I buying cars? Where are they?
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Let me see, where am I up to here? So, a time travel question for you, since we both enjoy that theme, I can see. If you had a time machine and you could go back to one moment to witness something in to you to history, what would you see?
I'd go back to the coronation of Anne Boleyn. I mean, obviously that's like a very obvious answer for somebody like me, but I would want to see her at the moment of the zenith of her power. I think that would be incredibly interesting. And I kind of want to know how she was received because, you know, depending on who you talk to, but, you know, that some of the historical sources say, well, you know, people were celebrating in the street and others were, you know, say, well, everyone was, you know, very quiet, not very happy about this. So I kind of want to know how that was actually received. And I just want to see the spectacle of it. I think it would be amazing to see the Tudor kind of period putting out all the stops and putting on a show.
Definitely. I know. I think, like, I've read it, you know, accounts of Anne's coronation and other Tudor coronations, and you just, it's hard to imagine. Like, I just would so love to see that in the flesh, I suppose. And as you say, in particular for Anne's, I would also love to see how people were reacting, whether really, you know, whether no caps were, what do you call it, thrown up in the air or not, or yes, or so that would be, that would be fantastic. I agree with that. Now, what was your first paid job?
My first paid job, you're not going to believe this. I worked in a bookshop.
There's a real bookish theme to today's podcast, I'm sensing.
Yeah. You know a lot about me by now. Yes, I worked at a local bookshop when I was in high school. I worked there for about 3 years. So, yes, bookshop.
Excellent. I have this kind of fantasy that, apart from the fantasy of moving to Tassie, or maybe actually they go together, is opening a little bookstore with, you know, just cozy and nice armchairs to sit in and beautiful books. That's another one of my kind of fantasies.
I have that fantasy too. Absolutely. It sounds so lovely. Yeah. But I have to say, working in a bookshop is a lot less exciting than you think it is. From my memory, it was just a lot of people coming in and saying random things like, oh, have you got that new book? It's blue.
Yeah.
It's about this guy. I don't know what it's called. And it's kind of depressing also to see what people actually buy because they don't buy good books. Yeah. They buy, you know, the most popular books are very depressing. So my fantasy is not at all based on the kind of reality of my experience.
it's funny. There's a reader for everything, isn't there? Some books that you think, oh, my God, like, who's buying this? And then somebody wants to buy it.
There are lots of people who buy it, yes.
So interesting. All right. Last question, a bit philosophical for this one. What do you think is the secret to a happy life?
Finding what you love and pursuing it and being honest about what that is. So, you know, I've been extraordinarily lucky, you know, as you can tell, I like books and reading and, you know, I've pursued that throughout my career, even when, you know, people say to you when you're in, you know, first go to university, well, why do you want to do English at university? What sort of job are you going to get? Yeah. And I didn't care. I just wanted to read and to turn my love of reading and books and literature into a career. And I have, and it's been, you know, academia is hard and, there's lots of ups and downs, but, I knew in order to be happy, I had to really make that a central part of my life and not compromise. And I haven't. And now I have a job where I can read, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? That's like a dream come true.
Yeah, so I think just finding what you love and trying to make that central to your life and central to your work. I know that's a kind of privileged thing that, you know, I'm very privileged. I realize that, and other people, you know, have to get food on the table and can't necessarily, you know, turf their job in order to pursue their passion. But if there's a way to make your passion your career and to make it your job and to make it really central to your world, then do that.
Exactly. I agree with you. That sounds really good. So we've got our last little thing, which is, of course, our Tudor takeaway. So do you have a Tudor takeaway for us, Stephanie?
Yes, I do. There is an excellent website called Anne Boleyn Novels, and it's a WordPress website. So I'll give you the address, although you can just find it under anneboleynnovels.wordpress.com. It's run by a woman who has become a friend of mine. Her handle is Sonetka on Twitter.
Oh, yes, I know that. I've interacted with her on Twitter. For such a small world, isn't it?
I know, it's a very small Tudor world. So she runs this amazing website, which I've been able to plunder for my research just to a ridiculous degree. She reviews, she reads all of these books about Anne Boleyn that I have been reading as well. And she reviews them, and she's so clever and so comprehensive, and she's read every thing that you can possibly imagine and reviewed it. And she has all these great breakdowns of, you know, does she have six fingers in this book? Mm-hmm. Does she, is she, you know, is there purple prose in this book? It's a girl, you know, how do people cope with the birth of Elizabeth in this book? So she has these brilliant little categories that she uses to structure her review. And she's read, you know, there are lots of Anne Boleyn novels that are very not good.
Mm-hmm.
And she's persisted and read them all just for this project, this WordPress blog. And she's so great. And we've been working together a bit on the book, and I've been bouncing ideas off her and getting her to read all my stuff. And she's just so great. And you should all read Anne Boleyn novels to find the kind of novel that you're interested in.
Mm, that sounds fantastic. And what dedication. I'm always amazed by people's dedication. Sounds great. I'm positive that I have visited the site in the past, but I don't think I've been there for a time. So I'm going to go and check that out, see what the latest Anne Boleyn books are. That's a fantastic resource. Thank you so much. All right. Well, we've come to the end. It's been so wonderful chatting with you about Anne, you know, one of my favorite topics in the whole world. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Oh, thank you for taking the time to chat to me. And like I said, I could talk about this literally all day and all night. So anytime you want to talk Anne, I'm here.
Yeah, definitely. I think we should meet up for a coffee and chat Anne to our heart's content. That's going to be great.
Absolutely. It's great to have somebody in Sydney who knows all this stuff.
Isn't that nice? Yeah, I don't, you know, I had another friend, Dr. Lauren Mackay, that you might know, and she decided to move back to, you know, Europe. So that wasn't very, very handy for me. But anyway, we still chat, you know, which her book is also fantastic. Have you read her book on Thomas and George?
Yeah. Thomas and George, yes, absolutely I have. I agree, fantastic book. So we'll have to be each other's Sydney Anne Boleyn fans.
That sounds so great. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a lovely day, Stephanie.
You too. See you later.
All right, thanks. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.